Welcome to Philosophy of Now on Roots Media. Today we speak with Dr. Christian Branion, a climate scientist and researcher at NASA Goddard Institute of Space Studies in New York City. He is also a professor of engineering at Columbia University Barnard College. We talk about his upbringing, beginnings and contribution in science, climate change and the urban heat island, and what each individual can do to reduce their negative impact on the climate. All right, well, thanks for joining us on the podcast, Dr. Branion. I know you have a very busy schedule, and I appreciate that you're making time out for this.
Oh, yeah, very happy to talk with you today, and, you know, just really nice to reconnect with you and spend some time with you.
So to get started, I know you have a very interesting and intriguing academic and educational journey growing up in Houston, LA, then coming to the East Coast, and then spending some time not only in engineering and science, but in service. So could you give us like your personal perception of your journey? I think it's very inspirational.
Sure. Neither of my parents finished college. And so, growing up in Houston, you know, that was something that my mother emphasized that, you know, emphasized at an early age to me, you know, that she wanted me to go to college. She really stressed education. And, my journey was interesting because my mother really went through tremendous lengths to make sure I got a good education. When we moved from Los Angeles to Houston, she wanted me to be in a gifted and talented program. You know, she felt strongly, as most parents do, that I was gifted and talented. And there was this long waiting list in Houston, you know, to get into these gifted and talented programs at different elementary schools. And so she, you know, really just harassed different administrators at elementary schools to try to get me on the waiting list or get me moved up on waiting lists. And she finally convinced an administrator to let me take an exam. It was fortuitous because the administrator basically, you know, promised her that if I scored well, that she would, help me get into this elementary school. And, I don't know that the administrator expected me to score well, you know, but I did. And I became one of the only Black males at this elementary school in Northwest Houston. And yet I lived in a very different part of Houston, was even using, I'm pretty sure my mom wasn't using the actual address where I lived, you know, to make sure that I could go to this great school. So I'm living in what would probably be described as a low income community, and going to this very white elementary school with kids, you know, whose families made a lot more money. And, you know, I was successful there, just in large part due to my mom. I remember her teaching me multiplication before I started third grade, much to my chagrin. You know, I wanted to play outside during that summer, and she's forcing me to read books and to do multiplication tables. And, that was kind of also when I first encountered kind of, you know, bias and started notice bias and amongst my teachers. I could tell my teachers were surprised how good I was at math, you know, at an early age. And I remember them asking me questions even, you know, in third grade and fourth grade and fifth grade, like, how did you solve this so much quicker, you know, than all the other students, you know? And I would tell them the little tricks, you know, I came up with in my mind. But, you know, my mom just, you know, continued to be an amazing parent and push me. And so I ended up you know, continuing that path of being in these gifted and talented programs in middle school and in high school. I attended, you know, the Michael E. DeBakey High School for Health Professions in Houston, which was, you know, in the late 90s, one of the best public high schools in Houston. I got into an early college entrance program at Lamar University. So I essentially skipped my senior year of high school and I was taking courses at Lamar University in Beaumont, Texas. And, you know, that was an interesting turning point because I didn't have any money for college. You know, I had started saving money. And my plan was really to go to a community college and transfer, you know, to, you know, the most elite engineering school that I could get into that I could afford. So at that time I was thinking University of Texas, you know, in Austin.
Right.
And, you know, I ended up through a friend hearing about Morehouse College and a scholarship program that they had with the Georgia Institute of Technology. I found out later it's actually with other schools other than just Georgia Tech. But anyway, I really just on a whim applied to Morehouse College, got a full scholarship to Morehouse College and a partial scholarship to Georgia Tech all at the same time. And it just changed the whole trajectory of my life. And really, you know, just completely changed my circumstances. And, you know, all of this is really just due to the perseverance and, you know, hard work that my mother put into to raising me.
Wow. So, I mean, you brought up that being the only Black male or one of the only Black males in your elementary school, was like an eye-opening experience for you in terms of understanding bias. Now, when you pursue engineering or you get your PhD or you're now working at NASA, how does that evolve? How does that understanding of what other people's biases or their perception of you evolve now from being a kid to now, you know, a full, a recognized scientist?
Yeah, it's a great question. You know, I mean, it's been a strong evolution. I think the you know, a key turning point was high school and that time at Lamar University where, you know, I kind of made this conscious choice. You know, I think every Black male in America, you know, begins to realize that people see them a little differently, you know, particularly in the 90s. I would say every Black male in America, you know, by the time you're in middle school or so, you start noticing things. So I remember I started noticing white women clutching their purses, you know, when I'm in the elevator, or white women are, you know, walking to the other side of the street. You know, when I'm walking down the street, you know, so you go from kind of a cute, cuddly little boy at maybe age 10 or 11 to 12 or 13, you're a threat. And, you know, I think you have to decide how you're going to handle that. You know, how are you going to, how do you process that? What is the narrative you tell yourself? And I think the narrative that a lot of young men identify as Black decide to take is that, hey, you know, I want to make white people more comfortable. You know, what can I do to make them more comfortable? And I think I decided, you know, that I wasn't going to go with that narrative. I was going to go with something's wrong with them. Nothing's wrong with me. You know, something's wrong with them. There's nothing wrong with me. And that really was empowering for me. You know, when I was actually attended Morehouse College in Georgia Tech, as I said, it was they call a dual degree engineering program where you get a liberal arts education, you know, at a liberal arts institution like Morehouse College, for example, and then you get a primarily technical education at an engineering school or a technical institution like Georgia Tech, and that program was great because it makes you well rounded. But what stood out to me when I transitioned from Morehouse College to Georgia Tech was that the Black students and many of the other students of color at Georgia Tech, you know, had already internalized white supremacy, right? They already, you know, I remember one of the first meetings I went to at Georgia Tech, it was an African-American student union meeting. So, you know, this is a meeting where organizational meeting where all these students of color, particularly Black students, are coming together to support each other and collaborate. And, you know, you would hear, you know, I would hear Black students saying things like, oh, you know, really indirectly and insinuating that white students or Asian students were smarter than Black students, and Black students can't achieve the things that white students and Asian students can. And it was just clear that there was this self-hate being propagated and internalized. And I had not, you know, I had been in this sanctuary at a historically Black college, where I had, you know, I had certainly had some of that thinking coming into college, but by the time I had progressed through my applied physics degree at Morehouse College, I had professors, Black male professors that had gotten PhDs in theoretical physics from MIT and, you know, all these prestigious institutions, and really I had such a healthy view of Blackness, and had really, you know, had really come to understand white supremacy and structural racism in a completely different way than I think these students at Georgia Tech. So at that point, I really decided to engage and help these students. And that continued in graduate school. It's continued, you know, in my professional work. I think I've been in places where I've been surrounded by folks that identify as white, and I knew this is not the place for me to say anything if I want to keep my job, you know. But I'm very fortunate to have also been in some amazing places and amazing institutions where, you know, I can point out inconsistencies and biases and you know, things that look like discrimination, things that look like white privilege, at the very least unconscious bias. And, you know, this is something that I don't expect, and I don't think this has helped me necessarily advance my career. It's just something that I have to do to feel whole as a person and to feel that, you know, that I'm authentic, you know.
I want to come back to your combination of liberal arts and engineering and its impact on you. But before we get there, could you give the audience a understanding of what the urban heat island effect is to some extent, and what your role in city planning and consulting is with NASA?
Yeah, sure. You know, I generally am helping cities understand how to use satellite data and how to use climate projections, which are, you know, are long-term simulations of the Earth's climate. You know, helping cities understand how to use both of these types of data for their planning purposes. And this is really challenging for lots of local governments because, you know, while the data is stored efficiently, you know, it's stored in a manner that it's cost efficient, and you know, it can be for the most part downloaded and accessed for free. You do need some technical skills to access the data, though. You need to typically know how to do some programming. It's good for you to have some familiarity with geographic information systems. And so, as cities are, you know, challenged with so many different competing demands, they may not have the resources to take the time to really investigate, you know, satellite data and climate projections. Hmm. And certainly there's this unfortunate situation in the United States and other places where there's distrust of scientists, there's a lack of awareness of climate and climate change. So a lot of what I do is helping cities understand how to access the data, helping them understand the implications. And much of this work is focused on cities because there's a strong interest to help cities adapt to climate change and deal with the urban heat island effect. This urban heat island effect is a phenomenon in which cities tend to be warmer than their surrounding more rural environments. And this is because cities tend to have this concentration of built materials like concrete and asphalt, concentrations of buildings and roads. The cars in the cities are emitting emissions that have heat. And so there's waste heat associated with these emissions. The air conditioning units in the cities are releasing waste heat, you know, as are other elements that are typically found in cities. And in particular, these materials like asphalt and concrete are absorbing energy from the sun during the day and then actually releasing that heat at night. And so over time, this urban heat island effect develops and even intensifies if cities become more built up. And this results in sometimes some adverse impacts. This can make heat waves more severe in different parts of the city. This can have implications for air quality. And so, you know, cities plan for the future, they can take some concrete steps to help mitigate urban heat island and improve, you know, health outcomes and well-being for their residents.
So it seems like this concept is not at all detached from like the politics of education, resources, air quality, energy management, because you're really dealing with how a city is planned, who lives where, and concerning American cities and of course every city worldwide, how do you navigate the socioeconomic status of people within cities along with the science? Because it seems like it's totally related here.
Yeah, no, 100%. Well, you know, I in the past we've kind of understood that certain folks are going to be affected by heat differently than others, you know, and we've known that for some time. We still talk a lot about that. You know, usually we're focused on elderly folks, so folks that, you know, maybe living by themselves, may not have strong social connections, you know, they may not communicate with their children often or their neighbors often. So a heat wave happens and they may not be doing well on day two or three of the heat wave, and no one may know, and they may have an adverse health outcome. They may be hospitalized. Sometimes they're even passing away in their home. And yet we also recognize that even folks that are not elderly, you know, are really suffering during extreme heat events and heat waves. And so the tendency is that extreme heat events, heat waves, they tend to disproportionately affect elderly folks. And it turns out people of color and low income folks. And there's this correlation, of course, in the United States between income in cities and ethnicity and race, right? So this is challenging, right, to unpack and talk about, because when we think about when we think about addressing it, we should be thinking about who's the most vulnerable, who's likely to be affected. And, you know, a lot of folks are socialized not to talk about race, right? Not to talk about ethnicity in the United States. So this work really intersects with environmental justice and climate justice. I navigate it, you know, by really just focusing on the science and the health outcomes, which I think are explicit and clear. And just trying to visualize information in a way that people can ingest and digest. And so it really varies by who I'm talking to. You know, when I travel to Durban, South Africa, for example, to do a climate workshop, they're much further ahead in the US in their conversations about race.
Oh, wow.
Much further ahead. Oh, yeah. You know, they've gone through this whole deal with a truth, you know, having a Truth and Reconciliation Commission, and the population is you know, generally understands what apartheid was and the effects of apartheid. And so even South Africans identify as white, we noticed, at least when I was in Durban in 2019 for a climate workshop, you know, every conversation started with apartheid and how do we address apartheid? How do we decolonize our society? How do we address these wrongdoings? And in the U.S., we're not there yet by any stretch of the imagination. The idea of addressing systemic racism, addressing institutional racism, addressing the effects of redlining, for example, which was a policy that benefited people that identify as white, allowed them to create wealth through home ownership in a way that was not possible for people of color. We're not quite there yet, and because we can't even talk about race, right? We can't even talk about ethnicity. To talk about race is considered political, which is in some audiences, which is absurd, right? Like that's like saying to talk about sexism is political. It's the most convenient thing that a man could say, right? Is that sexism is political. So we could avoid talking about it. And it's the most convenient thing that people that identify as white could say is that racism is political so that they have excuse not to talk about it and address it. So, I approach it differently based on the audience. But I think that the science, usually leads the way and we're able to come up with some real solutions to address extreme heat.
Right. When you said, when you were just talking about how topics like these become political, I just thought of the pandemic and how somehow the virus and wearing, taking care of precautions like a mask has become a political statement almost, which is an absurdity, it seems.
I agree.
I wanted to go back to your combination of degrees and interests in liberal arts and education, because I do feel like in the engineering, physics, mathematics, programming world, there's almost like a disconnect in terms of not only an understanding of the humanities, but also a digestible presentation of the ideas in STEM. In other words, like the education of what's going on in the science world and the people's understanding of the science, there's like a big disconnect. And you seem to be someone who's very active in not only doing the climate science, but communicating it to audiences who can digest it and take some action. So why do you think that's important? And where do you think you were inspired to, take that step?
It's a great question. I think it came from, my own experience as a student. When I was a graduate student, I can remember taking a hydraulic engineering course and just struggling through the course, kind of feeling like, the approach to teaching engineering was that, hey, I'm going to kind of give you an outline and, you go home and teach yourself. You teach yourself fluid mechanics and you teach yourself about hydraulics. I'm just going to kind of guide you. Right. And I remember taking this course my senior year, my last semester, and then as a teaching assistant, the following fall, I graduated in the spring, and then I was a teaching assistant in the fall. I had to TA the same course that I struggled through in the spring. And, to me, it was unthinkable. I was like, why would you guys know I kind of, this course wasn't easy for me. Why would you make me a TA of the course? But it was really the best thing they could have done. It was a brilliant idea by the faculty. Because, I remembered my experience and I was always kind of thinking about how can I make the information more accessible to the students? How can I explain this in terms they understand? How can I meet them where they are? And in order to do that, you have to put yourself in someone else's shoes. You need to show some cultural humility. We often say cultural competency, but I would say cultural humility. At the end of the year of me being a teaching assistant, I won this award as teaching assistant of the year, like the best teaching assistant in the department. Mm. But when I thought about it, I was like, I didn't do anything dramatically different other than, instead of checking boxes and dotting I's and crossing T's, my focus was actually making sure my students learned the material, and I think that I've taken that same approach. You know, I'm always thinking about different people's viewpoint, you know, and so if I know, you know, using the phrase climate change is going to stop someone from understanding anything else I say after that, if their brain is just going to completely shut down because I use the phrase climate change, you know, I'm not too stubborn to not use a phrase like climate variability, you know, instead, or talk about extreme weather events instead, you know. And so I try to really meet people where they are. I listen to a lot of talks by others. And, you know, I think science is just critical information for everyone to have. It's not something, you know, it's unfortunate that we kind of teach youth, and people will often say that they learned math, you know, in middle school, high school, that they never, that they'll never use again, or that they've never used again. And like the reality is, like, you learning that problem solving, you learning that math, you know, opens up new possibilities in your thinking and what you're able to ingest and conceptualize, you know? And so really you're not learning anything, you know, you're not learning things for no reason. You know, when I was at Morehouse College, I didn't appreciate it fully, but I'm so thankful for having to take classes on music and religion and philosophy. Morehouse actually required, you know, 2 semesters of history, whereas a lot of science and engineering students may not take any history at the college level through their entire education. And it's no wonder that so many American scientists and engineers have no understanding of racism or white supremacy, because our education, because they, one, are not required to take history at any level in their undergraduate education, and two, because, you know, we live in a society where the dominant group doesn't want to talk about race, right? So by me kind of deliberately leaning in to learn about other cultures, to learn about different types of people, to think about how to communicate with them, you know, a concrete example of this was just me studying abroad in Japan. I did this twice, but just me, I was deliberate about wanting to understand different groups of people, people that didn't look like me. And I just hope that others would do the same, put themselves in other people's shoes, try to see things from other viewpoints, because in reality, it's enhancing your own understanding of the world and helping you grow as a person.
So in continuing the point you made about communicating ideas about climate science and climate variability to folks who might not have the accessibility to the data, what do you suggest to people who want to impact in a positive way the climate variability and the urban heat island effect, but they're just, you know, common consumers? So like, what steps or decisions can they, you know, make to assist in the process of slowing the variability down?
Wow. Well, you know, there's so many things, honestly, that we can do. I mean, the biggest thing that we can do is just try to reduce our own carbon footprint. You know, some of this requires lifestyle changes. You know, we can eat less meat. You know, and we can consume more vegetable or plant-based foods. What's fascinating about this, though, is this will likely extend your lifespan as well. We can think about the packaging and reducing packaging in the items we purchase. You know, just deliberately recycling and reusing items and reducing our waste in terms of at least how the whole earth is responding to emissions, you know, that would be really helpful. I think at a personal level, you know, in our own homes, you know, if you have the capacity at your own home. There's been lots of research that shows that reflective roofs and white roofs and green roofs, you know, have the potential to save you energy in your home by reducing the amount of heat that's absorbed by the top portion of your building. But you know, there's also other benefits that come with vegetated roofs. Stormwater can be absorbed, and so that we actually reduce the load on sewer systems and stormwater systems. And this again, you know, has implications for energy use and reducing carbon footprint. So I think the way we consume, you know, what we choose to consume, how we eat is a big role. And what I hope is what will happen soon in the United States is there'll be more local governments that implement recycling programs where folks separate their waste, you know, when they throw it out. When I studied abroad in Japan way back in 2003 in Nagoya, this was already required. Now you had to separate your waste. You had to separate the food. Yet way back in 2003, they already had toilets where you had, you know, two different options for the toilets. You know, an option for number one and an option for number two. You know, one for liquid waste, one for solid waste. So it's just amazing that a lot of these technologies and approaches have been out here for a long time. We've just been slow to adapt them. Right. In the U.S. I hope we see more of that.
Finally, I want to have a conversation about your trip to Japan particularly, but also your visits to the East and how Eastern philosophy, specifically Buddhism, has impacted you, your worldview, and your view on education, because I know that it plays a role in your life.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I think that just growing up in the United States, you know, I internalized, you know, white supremacy and had to really grow out of this myth that some human beings were superior to others, that some human beings had just uniquely had good qualities and other human beings did not, you know. And when I live with a host family in Japan, that really, you know, brought things full circle where and I was actually living with people that didn't look like me, and I had not had that experience, you know. And I was living in a society where Japanese people, you know, the folks around me, did not have stereotypes about me. You know, they really did not have these strong ideas about what Black people were like or what Black men were like. You know, it was more like I was a movie star. I was famous, you know, everywhere I went because there were so few Black people in Japan. And it made it so clear to me how strong stereotypes and prejudice were, because no one was afraid of me. Everyone wanted to talk to me. And everyone was so warm towards me when I was there. Not to say there's no biases or prejudices amongst folks in Japan, but it was such a strikingly different experience. You know, I always will say to people, I felt more free in Japan than I ever had felt in the United States.
Wow.
When I was there at age 20. Yeah, felt way more free there. And, you know, in the short time that I've been on this earth, you know, I've definitely tried to spend some time learning about Eastern philosophy. You know, learning about, in particular, about some of the educational movements in Japan. And, you know, I've really been inspired quite a bit by some of the educational movements in Japan that promote this idea of service learning, you know, where students could go out in the real world and actually help people and help institutions and help organizations. And learn at the same time, you know, and so that's what I've tried to infuse into my teaching. You know, I try to give my students, you know, at whatever level they're at, you know, high school students, college students, graduate students, you know, give them this opportunity to be humanistic and learn while they're also helping others, you know, and I'm really thankful that service learning is growing and catching on more. You know, I've had students help nonprofits through projects. I've got interns now that are developing training materials for, you know, municipal government in the city of Durban in South Africa. You know, I'm always thinking about how can I connect my teaching and my work to helping people and educating people at the same time. So, you know, again, just thankful that I've had an opportunity to learn about Eastern philosophy, to learn about, you know, Buddhism in particular, you know, as a philosophy that emphasizes that all people are equal and have the same potential regardless of race, you know, orientation, or gender. And, you know, I take that principle, that idea of equality, and just try to apply it to my teaching and my work, you know, in an equitable way.
Beautiful. Well, I want to thank you for your time, your insight, and your guidance through these questions. I hope everyone finds some inspiration in your gems.
Thank you. Great talking with you today.
Absolutely.
For more insightful conversations like this one, continue to follow us on the Philosophy of Now podcast and check out rootsmedia.org so we can all learn together, think together, and grow together.